Jefferson, and we're here this afternoon to speak to you about reimbursement for seating and wheelchairs in the U.S. The objectives of the course are, one, to understand the algorithmic flowchart for providing power wheelchairs, two, to understand the document flow for power mobility device guidelines, and three, to describe what a physician evaluation should entail. As we know, funding in the U.S. can come from many sources. It can come from Medicare, Medicaid, different private insurances, community organizations, including vocational state programs, and also different grants that are available for people to help with funding for medical devices. And so today we're going to talk a little bit about the generic process, just so we have like a feel for the whole entire flow when going and looking for funding from a funding source. And we're going to go into specific detail about the Medicare process simply because most of the private insurance companies are looking to follow the Medicare guidelines. And also, all the state Medicaid programs are supposed to be following the Medicare guidelines. So we're going to spend a lot of time talking about that and going through the Medicare-specific guidelines. And that's what the information you have in front of you is. It's a power mobility device brochure from CMS directly. So it's not somebody's interpretation of it. It's the actual information from CMS, so you hear in their words what they're looking at. And then also the second handout that you have is actually the algorithm itself. So you can see the nine-step algorithm and go and what needs to be gone through for a client to get a certain type of mobility-assisted equipment. So if we look at the generic process, first and foremost, most of the times in a medical model, individuals are referred by a physician for mobility-assisted equipment. Then an individual, the therapist, and or a supplier performs an evaluation. After the evaluation is done and equipment is trialed, the specific equipment needs are determined and the products are chosen. After that process, the client is in as actively involved in the process, and now the therapist needs to write up a justification letter detailing why this particular product is necessary and detailing why the different accessories that are also involved in the product are also necessary. And then the physician is involved as well, and usually the physician will review the letter of medical necessity. They'll date it and sign it. At that point, then the paperwork all goes to the actual supplier, and the supplier will send that information, the letter of medical necessity, along with the pricing and the price quotes to the third-party payer for approval. And if this third-party payer is a state payer or if it's private insurance, most of the times they'll get some type of feedback from the actual third-party payer saying that, yes, we think that this is medically necessary, or no, you know, they're not going to fund this particular type of device. For clients who have Medicare, they don't necessarily get that feedback directly from Medicare. So many companies will use some type of a review company, such as ADMC, so that they will get some feedback as to whether the particular order meets the medical criteria and that does it have a good chance of being funded by Medicare. And so the process is a little bit different from depending on the funding source. If DME is covered by Medicare, there are very specific guidelines for that. And so when we look at DME, that's where the wheelchairs and scooters fall underneath. And they're covered under the Medicare Part B insurance program. For these items, Medicare has specific guidelines to determine who's eligible for this. What type of payment they're going to provide for different types of wheelchairs, and what must be included in that price.
Okay, so now the supplier has a few choices to do with Medicare, and the first is, are they going to accept Medicare? And if they accept what's called Medicare assignment, then the supplier provides the DME that's prescribed, and delivery can take at least before, it could take up to 6 months, and then after delivery, the supplier bills Medicare, and so that's the first method. Medicare, once they're billed, may pay the supplier for the exact wheelchair provided, or they may determine that a lower cost wheelchair would have sufficed, and they pay the lower cost. Medicare may deny the claim and refuse to pay the supplier for the wheelchair. The patient still gets to keep the DME. So, some suppliers do not accept Medicare. If the equipment supplier does not accept Medicare assignment, the patient is then asked to pay the supplier directly for the cost of the DME. The supplier then offers to send the paperwork to Medicare, and Medicare may reimburse the patient for the DME provided. Very few patients select to go this route, and so it's not usually a route taken by the patients. Okay. Mary already said something about ADMC, but because Medicare is so complex, many of the suppliers, before they agree to provide the equipment to the individual, they use what's called advanced determination of medical coverage. Now, it's not guaranteeing payment, but it's bringing in experts to make sure that there's potential to get paid. And so they look at the paperwork, they look at what's going on with physician referral, physician documentation, and that type of thing, and then they'll submit it. So again, it's not a guarantee, but oftentimes, and especially now in this time of changing over to the new AME, we've gone a lot more with suppliers using the ADMC. Do you want to add?
Yeah, also there are times that clients need accessories or parts of the device that Medicare does not necessarily fund, such as a seat elevator for independence and safety withstanding. And so it's just important to know that if Medicare wouldn't traditionally fund this, they have they can still get that part of the product. The only thing is that they have to actually fill out some extra paperwork for that, and we'll go into that in a little bit. But they still can get the product that they need. It's just that for that part of it, they may have to pay privately for that one item.
So there are a lot of suppliers out there who are hesitant to accept assignment, and you can understand why. Okay, and I think we're going to see a lot more hesitancy now that there's much more regulation, and that's what we're going into the process for getting the mobility assistive devices. Okay, one of the fears is that Medicare will say it's a good device, but they're using a lower cost alternative, and so the suppliers are already planning on taking lower reimbursement for the Medicare client as it stands, and they are taking a chance that they could get even lower reimbursement than they thought they were going to get. Okay, one of the things that Jerry Dickerson was talking about is that it's costing them more to store their documentation than it is to store their equipment, because they have to have 7 years worth of documentation kept, and at any time within that 7 years, Medicare can ask to see the documentation, and if they don't have the all the documentation there, Medicare can ask them to reimburse them for that product that they paid for in the first place. So it's a big risk now for suppliers to take on Medicare clients, and unfortunately, we're getting more and more Medicare clients, especially as we are all aging, and it's become a great dilemma. And so the question is going to be, what's going to happen in these next few years as things have really changed reimbursement-wise. So speaking of the reimbursement changes, one of the things that we really wanted to focus on was the Medicare policy changes that have occurred from 2005 on. And one of the things that was introduced in 2005 was what's called MAEs, And you want to really remember that term, MAEs, because when you get into a CMS website, oftentimes it's hard to find the specific information if you plug in wheelchairs. If you plug in MAEs, you'll find it. So mobility-assisted equipment is the term used for canes, walkers, manual wheelchairs, scooters, and power mobility devices. One of the things that changed with that Medicare policy is that it omitted chair or bed confined, which was a cool thing. I mean, we've been trying to get rid of that for a long time. So that ended, and the hinge to get the device paid for is now on function, and specifically mobility-related activities, spelled wrong, of daily living. So MRADLs. And so get used to that term as well. And that's a big term in all your documentation. The physician's documentation is MRADLs. Anything?
No, the brochure you have in front of you also has a lot of this terminology, and that's pretty much what's changed a lot with since 2005 is there are all these new terms that are being used, MAEs, PMDs, POVs, et cetera. And so all that information is in front of you in your handout. And actually on the second page of the CMS handout is actually some of the website information, so you know where you can go for resources, and you'll see this terminology up there as well. And so with the Medicare policy changes, some other thoughts were, or some other terminology was the PMDs, which is power mobility devices, and that includes scooters and power wheelchairs. And in order to get that, it has to be very clear in the documentation in the medical record that the doctor and the therapist are ruling out all the lower level equipment. It has to be specifically written out. It doesn't matter that a client has C4 spinal cord injury, complete tetraplegia. It's common sense to us, and it's really self-evident. However, Medicare wants it written out that they cannot use a walker, they cannot use a cane, they can't use a scooter because they need extra supports. So you have to go into that detail, unfortunately. And so that's what's different with the some of the changes that took place. In addition, they now recognize that they recognize that additional physician services and resources are necessary to establish and document the need for power wheelchairs. And so what that means is that they actually developed a code for doctors to be able to bill for the doing the actual paperwork for the power mobility devices. So it's just important to know that's a change that took place. It's a lot of question about the payment for the code and, you know, who's actually doing all the paperwork, but that's a different story.
There's what we call statutory requirements, and these are literal statements from the CMS regulation, and it's mandates that are needed in order for Medicare to actually pay for the equipment. If these are not provided, then there's reason for denial. And we chose not to put the percentages of denial in this presentation. That there was a survey done, and they provided percentages of documentation, but less than 30% was paid for because of lack of documentation, and so that's significant. And so the first thing that is being required is called a 7-element order, and we'll show you specifically what's on that 7-element order, but that absolutely has to be in, and the suppliers know this. I mean, they're not going to submit without it. But the key is that it needs to be within 45 days of the completion of a face-to-face process. And we're going to talk about the face-to-face process and what date we're actually talking about, because there's a lot of different interpretation on those dates. A face-to-face examination is absolutely mandatory for powered mobility devices. Okay? And documentation of that face-to-face examination in the medical record is required. And it has to be within 45 days of the completion of the face-to-face. And then the last thing that's required is the physician now needs to sign the product description and quote and date it and return it to the supplier.
Go. Okay. So just to remember, the PMD, or the power mobility devices, also include scooters. So include scooters and all basic levels of wheelchairs, power wheelchairs.
Correct. The question or the comment was that there is nothing from CMS that states that an OT or PT evaluation is required, so the supplier is calling the physician for that information, and that's exactly what's happening. Now, the physician has the ability to say that they're going to be using an OT or a PT's evaluation and make that requirement himself or herself, and then use their face-to-face plus the PT-OT evaluation. And so if a physician feels that they need that OT-PT input, which the physicians that we work for do, they'll refer them to the seating clinic. And so they'll stop the supplier from continuing the process and have that OT and PT evaluation, but the OT-PT evaluation is not a requirement.
And making sure that the physician has seen the patient within that 45 days. Because there seems to be a lack of knowledge from the clinical side as an OT as to what the CMS requirements are. I had to do a lot of digging prior to April 1st just to find out what my job was as a therapist. And then since April 1st came on, now doing a lot of interfacing with the vendors, I'm finding that the documentation, you know, we can reduce that 6 months if it's there and getting the physician buy-in. So that's, you know, I think the AOTA and the APTA prior to April 1st really nixed the idea of the therapist getting that certification and waived it. I'm not sure if they're going to require it next year, but all of the vending companies had a real issue after April 1st continuing with complex rehab and power because they didn't have enough ATPs or ATSs on staff. So that's what you may see as a lag now is there aren't enough vendors that meet the CMS requirement to have that ATS as part of their billing requirement in addition to the physician order. So, you know, there may be some lags probably within the next couple months just getting the equipment out because it was kind of a partial implementation of a CMS regulation. So I'm encouraging all therapists, get your ATP. The test isn't that bad, but that's going to help you get the product, and that was one of my frustrations was waiting 6 months from the time I identified a need to getting the equipment. So, you know, I think, you know, that's what we need to do.
So I think the what's happening is there is a change throughout the country, but this is something that's been 3 years in the works, and I know a lot of suppliers have been gearing up for it and getting, making sure that some of the people who work for them have become or have sat for their ATS certification. The ATP is not necessary for power mobility devices, but definitely the ATS is. And a supplier has to have an ATS on staff for to be able to provide a certain level of power mobility device to their clients.
And we screen, and there are two suppliers that we work with that do not have the ATS, and our schedulers know who they are, and they cannot schedule someone who has Medicare as their reimbursement with one of those suppliers. So, you know, as the therapist, we're very savvy in that we're making sure that our suppliers have the ATS if they're going to do the power mobility eval with us. And the suppliers are responding that those two are going to be sitting for an ATS exam very shortly.
The question is, when will the manual wheelchairs be under this regulation? And I think there's a lot of work being done right now, but there's no time frame that I'm aware of for that to take place.
How about certification so that the practitioners know what they're doing?
The question is whether when – that's a great question. If there'll be a certification for the practitioners to pass to say that they have a certain competency level to order wheelchairs. And unfortunately, there's nothing to that effect at this point in time. And I think that the AOTA and the APTA are not necessarily in favor of that because they feel that a therapist or a practitioner actually gets that entry-level knowledge base from their education program. Now, that's debatable, but that's what's their perspective at this time.
I guarantee you it will not happen because what AOTA and APTA did was to take their licensures throughout the country and make the statement that because they have a do-no-harm in all of their state licensure practice acts that a therapist should take it upon herself to self-regulate because of that license. And so they fought, because this was the CMS regulation for an ATP was the only funding regulation ever that would require somebody to have, that was a licensed therapist, to have a specific certification in order to provide a service. And they don't want to go that route. And they paralleled that, because at first I was arguing it with the legal department at AOTA, and they told me, do you have a certification in pediatrics? And I said, no. Do you do seating for pediatrics? Yes. Well, what if you needed to have a certification in pediatrics to do seating for pediatrics? You needed a certification in spinal cord to do seating for spinal cord. They said, you would put our therapists in a position where they'd be getting certified in everything they do and preventing them from treating. And so that was the status that they took, and they will fight a funding regulation for that. They won't fight a competency, but they'll fight, if a funding agency says you need to have that. It's like that when the CHTs got theirs, they worked with AOTA and APTA so that you wouldn't need a CHT in order to get paid. You can have it, but you don't need it to be funded. And that's the difference. AOTA...
There
isn't one, and Resna's working on one. And the question is, there is no certification right now for therapists in seating, and there's not. And Resna is looking to advance certification for seating right now. And they have, and, you know, you will hear about that at the town hall meeting. And if you want specifics, you want to talk to Laura Cohen.
Okay. So moving on a little bit in terms of what are the actual requirements and what exactly is necessary, at the actual doctor's or from the actual physician visit, what's necessary is an actual prescription for the piece of durable medical equipment, a chart note from the physician with the whole algorithm in that chart note, and a prescription for OT or PT if the doctor is going to refer the client for further evaluation, and that would be for a power mobility device evaluation. And so a client can get the equipment with or without an OT or PT, some of the power mobility devices, and sometimes the doctor can actually write the prescription then and there, or if the doctor feels that this is too complex, what they'll most often do is write a prescription for OT or PT to follow up and do the whole evaluation at that point in time. And so after that, oh, somebody has a question? It has to be a physician chart note. So the OT or PT can coach the doctor in terms of what needs to be in there, but it actually has to be in the doctor's chart note by them, and it can be typed in their chart note, however their traditional chart notes are done. What CMS is looking for is they're looking for a pattern. They're looking to see that the client has if it's a client with MS, that there's been like a decline in function and that they've been changing. So they want to see those notes to qualify that, and that's what the chart notes are all about. And so we'll go into a little bit more detail. Actually, I can go into the detail now. When a client actually goes for the physician visit, the physician actually has to start the note by saying that the client is here primarily for a mobility evaluation, and then go on about the whole algorithm. So it's really important for CMS to see that was the primary reason for the visit, and then the mobility issues are addressed at that point. It doesn't have to be a specific physician. You mean it could be the client's internist or physiatrist or neurologist. It could be any of the above.
And then the other team members' notes also have to support it.
Right.
If you have one nurse that says, oh, he doesn't need a wheelchair, or a doctor said that, and they're not informed,
right,
then they could disqualify.
The comment was that if there's other team members that don't support the need for the powered mobility device, they can be disqualified. Yes, if Medicare reads those notes, you're right.
So it's helpful to also have, like, the therapist evaluation. So I know for the suppliers that we work with, we also give in our evaluation form itself, and we actually have the doctors review it and sign it as well, just to help qualify the need for the device. So that's also considered chart notes, not necessarily MD chart notes, but it's therapy chart notes. In addition, the medical record has to be have very specific information about, like, the client's past and present equipment that they've used and what problems they've encountered with that, as well as different functional deficits that they have in mobility and limitations that they have with their mobility-related activities of daily living. Do you want to qualify?
Yes. Yes, if this that part where you're talking about the functionality, that can be the therapist's information, and the physician has that documented that they are taking and agreeing with what the therapist has stated, because our physicians, we have an 11-page document that we use, and our physicians get that before the face-to-face, and in their documentation, yeah, they have it before the face-to-face, just because. We're the ones that are recommending what type of power, you know, are they using a scooter, are they using...
Did they come to you from
that
first?
No.
The question is about the timing of the face-to-face, and there's a lot of question about that,
right.
Actually. When, you know, what's the date that should be on the face-to-face?
And we'll get into those scenarios, because there's several different scenarios that can work depending on the model that you work in. And CMS has recognized that, and also the... therapy groups, supplier groups, and NCART worked with CMS to let them know the different scenarios that would occur for somebody to get a scooter or a power wheelchair.
So the bottom line is that a face-to-face visit with a physician is necessary for all power mobility devices, and that the documentation has to be very specific. So what does the documentation entail? What is the doctor's prescription for the DME? Well, the doctor's prescription for the DME actually has to have 7 elements in it, and those are the elements that are written up there. And those elements are also in this on the CMS website, so you have easy access to it. It has to have the person's name on it, has to have the description of the item that's being ordered, and that could be power wheelchair with a tilt and space system, or it could be a power-operated vehicle, whatever the client needs. It doesn't have to be specific in terms of brand names. It also has to have the actual date of the face-to-face examination. It actually has to say that, date of face-to-face examination, and then there's usually a date right next to that. It has to have the pertinent diagnoses and conditions related to the need for the power mobility device. So all the diagnoses that are there have to be on that. The length of need for that actual device. It has to have the physician's signature, and they also have to date next to their signature. So they have to have 2 dates on that one note. One of the dates is saying that the date of the face-to-face evaluation is, and the other date is next to their signature that they sign it. And it's really important, because if they don't have those dates, then they don't have the necessary 7 elements. It's redundant, but unfortunately that's what CMS is looking for. Do you have a question? Oh, absolutely. If anyone wants a copy of the PowerPoint, I can absolutely send it out. Just get me your email address, and we can send it out to you. We thought it was more important, though, to have the CMS information, so you're hearing it directly with the CMS language, and that's why your handouts are the brochure at this point. But if you find this helpful, absolutely.
I know, but they're taping.
Oh, okay. Thank you. Who's educating the physicians, and who's taking the responsibility to ensure that this is appropriate? Is it the supplier?
In real life, yes, it is the supplier, and it's also the therapist in real life. If you ask CMS, that's actually one of their responsibilities for CMS to be doing this, and the different regional medical directors are supposed to be managing that. But as we know, that's something that's not being done to the level that it needs to be done, and that's a very politically correct answer.
On that note of the doctors, is it just physiatrists, or is it any physician? You know, I mean, now you have a lot of them going in the past to cardiologists and physicians that had no clue about wheelchairs.
So is it just going to be that they have to be a physiatrist with a rehab background, or they can go to the general practitioner?
It's any medical doctor can sign off on this. And sometimes it is just a cardiologist because somebody has major cardiac compromise and may need a power-operated vehicle to put for that.
And nurse practitioners are also able to do it.
In the handout, it actually tells you that it says...
physician assistants.
Right, exactly.
Hey, Jessica and Mary, Kay back here. It's great that you want to share your PowerPoint, but I would just tell y'all that I wouldn't stop that that's the definitive answer, because as soon as Jessica and Mary give you the PowerPoint, CMS is going to change something up. So I wouldn't hold fast to what they give you, but use it as a baseline.
And the other thing is that, and the reason why we were hesitant to give you the PowerPoint is it's our interpretation. And so there's no interpretation in this, and that's why we gave it to you so that we didn't get busted for...
And there is, you know, just the guidelines are a little bit vague, quite honestly, and there are lots of people interpreting them differently. Different suppliers require different documentation, and, you know, they have the right to do that only because they're the ones who are taking the financial risks. So, I mean, we're very respectful of that, but this is what we're presenting today is what CMS's guidelines are, and then there's always going to be a little bit extra depending on the particular supplier. They may want an extra prescription pad piece of paper that actually says the name of the power wheelchair or the power mobility device on it. I mean, they're entitled to ask for that simply because of the financial risk. Karen?
As far as physicians or nurse practitioners or physician assistants signing off on the prescription, it has to be someone who has regularly seen the patient, at least in the state of Colorado, where I'm in the area of Colorado that I'm at, because it can't be, a lot of doctor's offices may have many physicians or PAs or nurse practitioners working with them, and if so, Dr. X has seen the patient most often, but then that patient goes in and sees Dr. L, and then Dr. L is the one who says need for power mobility, it doesn't work. It has to be the physician that has had routine care with the client. It cannot be a resident, maybe unless they sign off on it, but it has to be the physician that routinely sees the client. At least that's what we've been up against.
Right. I think that's true in most parts of the country, that everybody's expecting that it's a physician who has some familiarity with the actual client. And in the CMS guidelines, they also state that this physician, PA, nurse practitioner, also must be familiar with the provisions of, like, this document that's in front of you. And how many of them are that familiar with that? That's, you know, unfortunately it's not the case, but at least we know that that's also a requirement that CMS is stating. So anyway, this is the seven elements. That has to be in the documentation, no question about it. And we talked a little bit about the actual medical record, and we're going to go into more detail about that. If you look at the algorithm in front of you, it's the piece of paper that has all the triangles on it, for those of you who are not familiar with it. And this is what we're going to be speaking about now. And this is what CMS is looking for in the physician's chart note. They want to see this, that the algorithm has actually been gone through. So they want to know, does the individual have limitations of mobility that impair their ability to participate in their mobility-related ADLs? So they want to see that there's problems with feeding, grooming, toileting, dressing. They want to know how much limitation is there. They want to see that. They want to know if the client can accomplish the actual mobility-related activity or daily living, but if there's a safety risk with them doing it. So if a client is unsafe doing it, that will help qualify them for a device. And the question is also, can they accomplish that ADL within a reasonable period of time?
And these are the criteria that have helped tremendously to justify the jump up from a walker to a manual wheelchair or a manual wheelchair to a power wheelchair. And so regardless of whether the person can use a manual wheelchair, if I can document that they're not safe, and that the timing on it is just absolutely not functional, and have that in my notes, that is justification for the power, even though there may be a note written by the physical therapist working in the primary clinic that they're working on manual mobility. And so that, where when you get some of those dichotomies, you know, I'm focusing on safety and long distance function or, you know, timing, and they may be working on getting the FIM up, you know, and so having them do manual wheelchair, and that's going to happen. And so, you know, my note really has to portray the functionality and the safety. Are there clinical standards for those? No, there are not. It's very vague. Yeah, it's all subjective. Yes, it is. There are no clinical standards at this time.
So in addition to the mobility-related impairments, they also want to know if there's any other limitations that the client actually has, whether it's arm function or something else, and if and how they can compensate for that. As we move down the algorithm, they also want to make sure, and this actually has to be documented, that the, you know, does the client have the cognition, the judgment, and or the vision to actually participate in MRADLs? And do they actually want to use a power mobility device? It has to actually be stated that the client is willing to use this to be more independent and safe with their activities. And so if the answer to that is no, then the question is, can the ADL be accomplished with the assistance of a caregiver pushing a chair? And so that'll send you down a different track. If the answer to this question is yes, then you're going to list all the the doctor actually has to list the impairments that require the caregiver assistance for mobility. As you go down like the algorithmic flow chart, you'll start to see there's a whole hierarchy with the mobility equipment. And it's really important that as the doctor's note goes down, and even in the letter of medical necessity, that it's documented the different levels of equipment and why the client cannot use a specific level of equipment. So it's not redundant to say a client cannot use a scooter because it doesn't have the positioning lateral supports and hip guides to hold them upright. You have to actually write that and be redundant about the information.
And the good thing about the flowchart, and I do want to give credit to CMS for doing something that I think is really good, is that it does make sense. It's like, if you can't use a cane, can you use a walker? If you can't use a walker, can you use a manual wheelchair? If you can't use a manual wheelchair, can you use a scooter? So it makes a lot of sense, and for individuals, physicians or therapists who are not used to going through any kind of hierarchy, it's something that absolutely makes sense, and why, if you're recommending a power wheelchair, if they can do anything before it, then why are you recommending the power wheelchair? So in the good thing about it is that some of the processes that they have taken at least make sense.
So something else that's fairly important, and this is also another good thing, is that they actually are looking at the function, the safety, and the environment, and that actually has to be documented throughout. So if you're recommending a cane or a walker or a wheelchair for somebody, you also have to state that it's going to fit and work in their home environment. And so that's not something that we can take for granted. It has to be documented. So as you go through the hierarchy of the mobility assistive equipment, you start again with the canes, the walkers, the manual chairs, the scooters, and then you progress up to power wheelchairs. So one of our first questions is always, you know, will a cane or walker allow a client to safely participate in their ADLs in an efficient manner? And again, if the answer is yes, then that's what they're going to get. If the answer is no, then you have to describe, like, the impairments that prevent their use for this equipment. And so for, again, somebody who, say, has MS with paraplegia, you need to just write for that specific client that the client is unable to use a cane or a walker because they have complete plegia of their lower extremities and need to be sitting for their mobility-related ADLs.
Yes?
I have patients with MS that want to be able to walk as much as they can and manage the cane because they're not functional hand wielders. And so I document that they're not functional, consistently functional hand wielders because of activity tolerance.
Right.
Does that work?
The question is, for clients who have MS, they do ambulate, but their ambulation is more for exercise purposes as opposed to functional ambulation. They can't go into the kitchen and get a glass of water and come back to the living room, but they do get up and use their cane or their walker for exercise purposes.
Yeah, throughout the day.
And throughout the day, yeah. And so it just has to be documented that it's not for mobility-related activities of daily living, that they are using it for exercise purposes, and that they can safely, you know, do. And then you have to talk about the mobility-related ADLs again. Can they, in terms of their dressing, can they go and take out their clothes with the cane or walker?
I have another patient who needs a power wheelchair.
Speak into the mic.
I have another patient who needs a power wheelchair for many reasons, but does not want one because it's a symbol of disability. And she wants a manual chair, which I don't recommend at all, but can I script it? A manual chair?
Well, the question is, you know, again, and look at the second question on the chair, or it's in the second statement up there, but the most important thing for any device for Medicare is the client willing to use this? And unfortunately, that client doesn't see the value of it, and the answer is no. So they wouldn't qualify for it.
For a manual chair, they wouldn't
qualify. The power chair.
No, they wouldn't qualify for the power chair.
They wouldn't qualify for a power chair if they don't want to use it.
Exactly, but what about the manual chair that she wants me to get her?
Then she would qualify, because then when you look at the criteria, one of the criteria for the manual chair is can the caregiver push the manual wheelchair?
She doesn't have a caregiver, so I would just have to document that I educated her about the risks inherent in the manual chair, a risk of injury, because she's not appropriate for it.
And and that's a therapeutic judgment as to if you feel that you could actually recommend something that you don't feel she'd be safe with. But the question is, you know, in terms of going through the algorithm process, you'd have to say that she was safe in that that manual wheelchair for CMS to fund it. If you look at the algorithm, it clearly says, all right, after you state that the manual wheelchair is appropriate, you have to state if they're going to be safe in it.
I mean, the thing is, her shoulders are going to get worn down more than they are, and it's more painful for her spine to be sitting in that chair, but she doesn't want to give in to the illness.
Right. But
I understand
you can't force a purchase. I mean, so, you know, anything can be therapeutically, I don't care if it's medication or what, the patient has the right to refuse, and so that's your documentation. So you can't force a purchase.
Right.
You can't.
And also you want to make sure that you educate the person as much as possible. And that's all we can do with anybody. Each of us are entitled to make whatever decisions we make. As long as as a clinician, I know I will feel comfortable as long as I made all effort to make sure that that was an educated decision by the client.
And what about the rich people that can buy out of pocket whatever they want? Does any of this apply to them?
Well, if they don't have to worry about a funding source, no.
They're not going to use Medicare then.
Right.
But what are my ethics? So, you know, I don't have to get involved, apparently. And if they want me involved and I tell them something they don't want to hear, then I'm back up against, I have to document that I didn't recommend it.
Right. Well, that's a business decision, and that's also a decision that you make based on the particular person and the actual device that they're looking for. I mean, that's definitely an ethical challenge. When we look at the manual wheelchairs, again, we talked about that the client has to be willing to use it, definitely. And the question is, does the client have sufficient strength and the endurance necessary to propel an optimally configured manual wheelchair? And that's an important question because it guides you into the different parts of the algorithm. So if the individual doesn't and they have a caregiver who is available and wants to push them for mobility, then that's fine with the algorithm, and they would be appropriate for a manual wheelchair if it met their environmental needs and their safety needs.
I guess just to go back to the previous question, let's say 3 months down the road that lady acquires her manual wheelchair, has a few falls, and now wants to go to a vendor to get a power chair. We're in this area of, you know, 5 years or whatever between devices. Her documentation might say that she's already refused a power chair. What would CMS allow me to do if there's been a change? What does the vendor then acquire? Because now I may have to go through a different company to undo their billing of a manual chair to provide them a power chair. You see what I'm saying? So a lot of times we run into that the CMS algorithm doesn't account for.
Right. I think that there are going to be situations where either the person changes or their opinions change. And if willingness to use a piece of equipment changes through time, you can't deny them the piece of equipment that they want
Medicare
now.
Medicare may not pay
Medicare
for that.
Might not pay for it. Exactly
so
right.
Then,
and they
then you go back to the patient and say, I'm sorry, but I can't give you that. Because
if I was the supplier, I would do an ABN on that one. Because I supplied them with a manual wheelchair 6 months ago, and right. now they're coming back and saying they want a power wheelchair, which we had tried to talk them into before, and
right.
they said, no, I want a manual wheelchair. And so they got a manual wheelchair, and I
right.
would say, I'll work with you to put in for this because this is what we wanted originally, but you understand we are now asking the same payer source to pay for the more expensive seating system, and you've only had this one for less than a year or 2 years. You need to sign an ABN. And so, you know, again, it's the supplier's risk, and most
right.
suppliers will see that as an incredible red flag.
Right.
And that's a $20,000 chair.
And again, my you know, real world scenario was in a rural rehab hospital that didn't have any resources to educate the physicians. We had a patient with a cardiac diagnosis who then went to a local vendor to get a power chair. They were aware of the CMN requirement, referred that patient to me, and then on evaluation with a vendor present, we found the patient wasn't qualified. But lo and behold, a phone call comes in to the daughter, and there's a supplier bringing a power wheelchair to that patient's home, sight unseen. You know, so I mean, there's, it doesn't, you know, to me, it's a really difficult situation as a clinician because I'm not going to sign off that they're qualifying for a power wheelchair, but Medicare is paying for stuff anyway sometimes because it's not tightly regulated and it's so vague. Yeah, a physician, but they just wrote wheelchair. So hopefully the company doesn't get paid on it, but the patient keeps a piece of equipment. I mean, I don't understand the rationale of that.
Some vendors will say, well, the manual chair failed. We demonstrated that, now we can put in for a power.
But they're not doing, the vendor's not doing a functional assessment, so I don't know what they're documenting.
We've got some questions over here.
Could be either or. It depends. Some of the suppliers actually typed it up themselves because it helps them make sense of the regulations. But there's also information on the CMS website where they actually go through like the individual questions as well. It's a narrative, yeah.
No
checkoff.
No, no. And we'll get into that. The supplier cannot generate the documentation. The documentation has got to come from the medical people and be on the medical people's letterhead. And the supplier absolutely cannot generate any documentation at all. It will be denied. And that has been, we've tried to get that to go through for years, and it will be denied. Now, I will tell you that RIC developed a form because we have so many physicians that we work with, and when this started to come out, you know, as much as you try to educate, there's just no way you can educate all the physicians that are dealing with every patient that goes through our door. And so I sent our form, and Jerry showed our form to the CMS and the DMIRCs, and they made the statement, and they can't put this in writing, so it's kind of risky. They made the statement that because it was generated by our facility and because it's physician and therapist generated and it went through the entire algorithm very thoroughly, that they would accept it. And we're incorporating that into our computer now, so it won't look like a checklist. It'll come out in paragraph form. But until that happens, it's a checklist form. Two of our suppliers accept it. One of them doesn't. Okay, they won't accept the form. And that's their right to say, no, we don't want to take a chance. We want it to be a narrative form. But absolutely, CMS will not accept anything from a supplier that's at all looks generated by a supplier. Right, Jerry? Okay. Yeah.
So anyway, we went through the manual wheelchair. I think it's pretty self-explanatory at this point as we're going through the algorithm. And now the next question is, okay, what moves us on to a power mobility device? And again, the power mobility devices are scooters, which are the power-operated vehicles, or a power wheelchair. And so Medicare will only cover these devices if they're necessary for mobility-related ADLs within the home. So that's not new, but it's something that's really important that that's documented. And if the client can safely use any of the below devices, as we talked about already, then they will not qualify for a power wheelchair. And the client must exhibit, and it has to be written in there when you're writing that they need a power wheelchair, that they cannot use a manual wheelchair within their home, and they cannot walk using any type of assistive device. So it's just going through that whole algorithm. Once you did that, it just moves you up the list to write to power.
Any way in which you can write in anticipated future needs for someone with a progressive disease, for instance? They may be able to do this now, but it's expected 2 years from now they'll have reduced function in that area?
It depends, I think, on the diagnosis itself, but many times CMS isn't paying for future needs. They want to see that there's a need now, and then you can move on from there. But most of the time, people with progressive diagnoses also happen to have neurological diagnoses, and that puts them into a whole different category of wheelchair. So it's important just to know that, which then hopefully has the electronics and seating flexibility to meet their changing needs. So when you start with the power mobility devices, it's important to start, of course, with the scooter. And we went through this already. And if a client is being recommended for a scooter, it has to be documented that that scooter can actually move around within their home. And so that's a really interesting question coming from, like, the New York City, New Jersey area, because many times the scooters don't fit within their homes. And so if it doesn't fit within their homes, then that scooter is not appropriate, and that would move them on to a different type of power mobility device. And so that's something to remember as you're going through your paperwork. We have to talk about the environment and function. Some of the other questions are, does the client have sufficient trunk strength to sit in a scooter? Do they have the grip to actually operate the tiller of a traditional scooter? Do they have the upper extremity function to hold their arms out and take care of that and position their hands on the tiller? Do they have the adequate sitting balance to sit up in the seating that's provided in a standard scooter? And do they have the transfer skills to get on and off of that scooter safely? So that has to be documented when looking at a scooter. And if yes, then the client would be qualifying for a scooter or a power-operated vehicle. And it's important to remember, you need that face-to-face visit for this. There's a lot of misperceptions about it, but you need a face-to-face visit with a doctor for a scooter and for any type of power mobility device. If the client didn't have adequate trunk strength, if they didn't have adequate upper extremity function, et cetera, then that would actually be a no for this question, and that would put them right into the qualifications for some type of power wheelchair. So now as you move on to power wheelchairs, the question is, one, does the individual have the physical abilities to consistently access a drive control? Other considerations are, besides just driving the actual device, is, do they have the need for any type of alternative positioning seating system or any alternative type of drive system for their ability to participate in their activities of daily living? So this would include, like, tilt and space systems, power recline systems, power elevating leg rest systems, et cetera. And, of course, the main question that also has to be documented, and it may seem redundant, but you have to talk about the client's cognition and their judgment and their vision in terms of their ability to safely operate that power mobility device. So, of course, if the answer to these questions are yes, then they would get you'd start moving into the whole powered mobility device options. And if no, then you go back. And like your client with the manual chair who was not interested in using this power mobility device, then it put them back into the category of a manual wheelchair. So when we talk about power wheelchairs, that's just a vague term that actually ends the algorithm, and it qualifies a client for a power wheelchair. But now there are different groups of power wheelchairs, and in order for a client to qualify for one of the particular groups, there's another set of criteria for that. And so we just wanted to make sure that you were aware of that today, and that the groups are six different groups in the power mobility category, And the first one is those light-use type mobility devices that don't necessarily have a lot of durability and are not designed for somebody who needs them 24/7. It's something that's a really light-use power product. The Group 2 devices are considered consumer rehab type devices. And they come in three different configurations. And the configurations are no power option. And what that means is no power seating option, just so you know. So it would be just a standard type of seating system that's on there. Or it could come with a single power option, which would mean just one type of power seating system, such as a tilt and space system. Or it could come with a multiple power option, which would be a tilt and space and recline seating system. So it's important to know that the consumer rehab comes in three different categories. As you move up into a Group 3 device, that would be considered complex rehabilitation power wheelchairs. And so for a client to actually qualify for this level or this group of chair, they'd have to exhibit some type of neurological diagnosis. And it pretty much has the same three categories that we talked about for the Group 2 devices. The next level is a Group 4 power mobility device, and that's considered high activity use. And there are numerous power chairs out there that are high activity use. Unfortunately, Medicare will not fund these devices. So it's important just to know that Group 4 chairs, they have a grouping for it, they have different codes for it so that other funding agencies will recognize it. However, Medicare will not fund a Group 4 device.
And all your manufacturers will provide you with what group their chair is in. And so you want to get that directly from your manufacturer or from your supplier because that they'll give you the codes and the group that they match. And so rather than have Mary and I interpret which group went into what, you'll just work with your manufacturers and they have that, right? You manufacturers out there, are there any manufacturers out there? Pride's here. So, you know, get that from them because they'll be able to provide you with those exact, and they can change groups. And so that's why, again, you want to work with your manufacturers because their goal is to try to provide the proper equipment for their consumers, but they want to make sure that they get the chair put in the right category so that they can get the funding that covers their costs for manufacturing that chair. Right. The question is, she's been told she doesn't need an RTS involved in Group 1 or Group 2. And oh, an ATS. Actually, we call them ATSs.
Group 2 single power.
Group 2. All right, Group 2. No power option. Up to a Group 2 single power.
Could you repeat that whole sequence for clarity?
Sure. The question was an ATS, a resident-certified ATS, they are necessary to evaluate what types of power chairs. And basically, it's a Group 2 single power option and above. So for light-use Group 1 devices and for Group 2 no power option devices, you don't necessarily need a ResNA-certified ATS to provide that type of device.
And for the most part, those clients are not your typical rehab clients.
Part of the homebound definition for Medicare allows the patient to go to doctor's appointments, to church, grocery store, yada, yada. But the other part of Medicare says that I can't script a chair for use outside the walls of the house. Is that still current?
Right.
Is that in Congress right now?
No.
There was no regulation. The question is, do you, for any type of mobility device with Medicare, it has to be necessary for mobility within the home. If it's just needed for mobility out of the home, unfortunately, Medicare doesn't recognize the medical need for that. So that's for all mobility devices, canes, walkers, everything.
I also have a question about used equipment. Is there any interest in regulating what happens to that other the used equipment?
Not right now. Just because of liability aspects and stuff like that. So we don't know where that's going. You know, there's libraries and everything else where you can get used equipment, but they can't, a supplier can't charge for that.
That's pretty scary.
So, okay, in terms of power wheelchairs, the other two groups that we didn't discuss yet were just pediatric power wheelchairs, and that would be a group 5 level, and that could come in either a single or a multiple power option. And lastly, there's a group 6, which is a miscellaneous category, and the power mobility product that fits into that category is the pushrim activated power assist device. So that's the motion wheels or the extender from Quickie. So just to summarize so that it's clear for everyone, the physician evaluation is essential for any type of power mobility product. They have to complete, the doctor actually has to complete a 7-element physician note. He also has to complete a chart note with the whole algorithm in it. And he has to write a device, some actually suppliers request an actual prescription pad paper that says on it power mobility device, that they need a power mobility device. And if they're recommending, if the physician's recommending a client to go to an OT or PT evaluation, again, it has to just say power mobility device evaluation after OT or PT. It just can't say wheelchair. That really isn't meeting the CMS requirements. It actually has to say power mobility device evaluation. And then we talked all about the medical record. I think everyone has a clear understanding of that at this point. And in addition to doing the evaluation in the clinic with a client, there's also a requirement that someone actually has to visit the client's home to make sure that the power mobility device is going to fit. And so oftentimes that falls on the supplier's shoulders, and they actually have to document that they brought the power mobility device to the client's home and that it fit in the necessary areas that it needed to.
Question?
Also, the supplier has to actually fill out another piece of paper, and that's the detailed product description form, and the doctor actually has to sign and date that as well. Did you have a question? Can we give him the mic? Right. So the statement is, and that's excellent, actually. The statement is that the MDA in upstate New York, or the MDA in general, actually, will usually fund a therapist to actually go and do a home evaluation with the client. And that home evaluation can actually be the home evaluation with the power mobility device, and then they would be funding for clients who have ALS for that, which is really great because there's no funding for the supplier for that. Right. So, and it's the MDA Association that's funding that visit.
But one of the things that is really creating a problem is this requirement for the home evaluation because most therapists are not funded if they're not home health therapists to go into the home and assess, nor do they have the time to go do that, and the suppliers don't either. And it's absolutely mandatory that it happen, and it has to be documented that the home is accessible.
I just wanted to ask a quick question about someone who clearly qualifies for a group 3. Imagine a person preparing for employment or who is actually trying to use public transportation to get to and from a work site and have a need for features that come from the high activity category. Are you saying there's never, ever a reason that any of those features can be funded by Medicare?
We're not saying never, ever anything to
okay.
start with.
All right.
But also,
they weren't set up with billing codes. Is that what I understand?
It depends, I think, on the actual item. So what specifically are we talking about? Is it the transportation brackets? So they're going to be safe in there?
Transportation brackets or, you know, shock, suspension, features of suspension or motor features, gearless, brushless, et cetera.
Yeah,
yes.
Why don't we have Pride, you know, since...
Julie's here.
But if the features necessary for that individual either wants or needs or convenience or whatever, the individual has the right to upgrade and pay the financial difference between the features that they feel they would like for whatever reason. So the chairs are still available, and they would be funded at where medical necessity coverage criteria falls.
Right. And then also not to forget that, you know, this is a funding lecture and we're talking about all types of funding. And all of the states have state vocational agencies who may actually pick up the difference there to help fund those products that are necessary for independence in the workplace or at school. So it's important to remember that.
Also to weigh in for your suppliers, that Medicare also now has supplier standards. So for your suppliers that are going to be doing the high-end complex equipment, they're accredited by outside agencies like Joint Commission and others. So they also have a grievance process. And ResNA also has a grievance process if you feel an ATS is not applying within the standards of practice and the code of ethics of the ATS, you do have a grievance process, as also with some of the supplier accreditation agencies.
Okay, one of the things that we wanted to get through is this. The face-to-face date question is huge and has been interpreted many different ways by many of the suppliers. At RIC alone, we have four different suppliers, and each of the four different suppliers have their version of the process. And we need to follow their version of the process because they're the ones who are taking the risk for payment. But in working with several of the DMIRCs and people that have been working directly with CMS, this is what we've come up with. This is our interpretation of what we're hearing the face-to-face date is. And we wanted to cover some of the scenarios and work with you on this so that we can talk about it and see if there's agreement on it. Okay, so what we're finding is that your face-to-face is the final step for the physician involvement and where that signature takes place. And your first scenario would be the physician does the eval, there's no therapist involved, the physician makes the recommendation, goes through the algorithm, that's the date of the face-to-face. The other is where the therapist is involved first. They've gotten a referral through their hospital, they've gotten a referral from the PTs on the floor. Face-to-face, the patient has not seen the physician yet. So the therapist does the evaluation, provides that documentation, and then the physician does a face-to-face. There's two ways that that face-to-face date occurs. One is the physician has the therapist's evaluation and all the recommendations and everything is there. They see the patient, and that is their evaluation date and their documentation date. The other is the patient goes to see the physician, but the final decisions and the final documentation from the therapist hasn't taken place. So the physician sees the patient, then sees the therapy eval and signs the therapy eval. That signature on the therapy eval is your face-to-face. So you've extended the amount of time that you've been provided to allow for the supplier to meet that time.
And that therapy eval could also be the letter of medical necessity. So that's what that's when the face-to-face would be completed, when the doctor reviews the letter of medical necessity. And actually, there's a would actually have a line on the bottom of that letter of medical necessity saying that I read the above, I agree with the above, and I concur with this evaluation, and they actually have to date it as well. So it's not sufficient to just have the date on the letter of medical necessity that's typed. The doctor actually has to sign and date it when they actually review it, and that's the day the face-to-face is completed.
And so I really advise all of you therapists out there to forward your
not just your letters of medical necessity. We have a combined evaluation letter of medical necessity, but the documentation that you're using for the doctors to sign it in agreement. And so because those are going to be looked at as dates, either with the face-to-face date or the doctor agreeing with date and then doing his face-to-face.
Right. So when that seven-element form is completed, the doctor would actually write on that the date of the face-to-face was completed on this day. And the doctor doesn't necessarily have to see the patient on that day, but that's the date that the whole evaluation, that face-to-face evaluation, was completed. Another scenario that we didn't discuss yet is clients who are being discharged from a rehab hospital. They don't have to go back to see their doctor to do a face-to-face evaluation because the day of their discharge is considered the date of the face-to-face evaluation. So that's something that we should also mention as well for all the inpatient clients who are leaving and have a need for a PAL mobility device.
Do any of the suppliers disagree with that? Because we want to make sure that the suppliers are on the same page as we are. Right.
Right. Absolutely.
Not just because they were discharged.
No, Jerry. Right. It's similar documentation, actually, that they have to actually write the seven elements and all that day. It's just what's the date on it, and that date would be the day of discharge. But Jerry's 100% right. They have to write and go through the algorithm in that discharge note, and they actually have to have the seven elements prescription as well. One more thought is you're hearing all about like the face-to-face evaluation. It's necessary for all power mobility products. Something that's important to know is that it's not necessary. This face-to-face evaluation is not necessary if a client has a previously Medicare-funded power base. That's one thing. And it's also a face-to-face evaluation is not necessary when only accessories are being ordered. So if you're just ordering accessories, it wouldn't be necessary. Which one? The question is, or the statement is that actually when the face-to-face evaluation isn't necessary, if a client, and we should qualify this, did a face-to-face evaluation for a power base, if they have that and they just need like a seating system added to it or something along those lines, they don't need a face-to-face evaluation for that seating system or when any accessories are being ordered.
No, what he is saying is that the line here is incorrect. So that if a patient, and that is good to know, because we are taking this from CMS literature, and so that's good to know. And what Jerry is saying, and believe me, if anybody knows anything about funding with Medicare, it's Jerry and Julie, what they're saying is that if a patient had a previous Medicare-funded power base, go through the whole process. Okay? Julie.
Is within the five-year time frame of useful lifetime of durable medical equipment, and it's irreparably damaged, and it's documented that it's irreparably damaged and needs to be replaced. The medical record has to document that they didn't get better and still needs power mobility, but they don't have to go through the entire algorithmic approach to a face-to-face evaluation. If it's over 5 years old, and it's dilapidated, then they do have to go through the entire face-to-face algorithmic approach for funding of a new power base.
And Jerry, would you just have everybody go through? I mean, I'm thinking that what supplier is going to take that chance?
Well, it's all a matter of risk.
Yeah.
I wouldn't take it.
Because we just all go through it. There's no question you're going to get it, you're not going to get it. Everybody who's getting any kind of power goes through the whole algorithm.
Right. We do the same in where I work as well, simply because no one knows what's really happening with this funding. And, a supplier would be at risk financially with that. And so, of course, if a supplier is requiring it, then, of course, we'd do it.
So that's coming out of this handout right now, just so you know. It's deleted.
And I believe we've run into the situation where if a client has had a power chair funded by another source, and then that power chair needs to be repaired, and the client has then since switched insurances and has Medicare that they you first have to document that the person under CMS guidelines would qualify for a power chair for them to repair the existing power chair.
Did everybody get that? That if somebody had a chair previously paid for by another source and now they're Medicare and they need repairs, you need documentation similar to the algorithm that justifies the repair because Medicare never paid for it.
I have found funding privately for features that aren't covered through like muscular dystrophy and MS Society, that sort of thing. So don't forget about those sources.
Right. Are there any other questions?
Involved, the PT or OT thinks power wheelchairs are unnecessary. They can be handled in other manners. And as a result, I never recommend that a PT or OT eval be done. When one customer just was turned down because a PT had said he can walk 1,500 feet and he feeds his dogs every morning, he failed to include the fact that he'd broken three bones in the last 6 months and his neighbors had picked him up out of his yard several times. And the PT told me he doesn't need a chair. He needs more therapy. But at his advanced age, I don't think he's going to get younger and I don't think he's going to get better. But what I'm saying is that there are a lot of doctors that rely on the supplier to say, to find out what needs to be done. And as a supplier, I don't recommend it. That a PT or an OT eval be done.
But not addressing that.
Yeah, I just wanted to say I think that when you do that, you're taking full liability. And so what I would recommend with you and the doc, because the doc, our physicians would never in a million years recommend the specific features on a power wheelchair, what type of power wheelchair, whether it should be a scooter or whatever. There is absolutely no way they would take that responsibility because they know they don't know it. That's not their interest. That's not their passion. It's not what they're expert at. And for a supplier to take on that responsibility, should something occur, you just negated a whole profession. And so, you know, what I would do is to find the experts or get those therapists trained. I mean, they need training, and that's what we've been talking about, is you do need to have some type of competency in seating and positioning in order to make that referral. And if you're working with a bunch of therapists that don't have it and you want to have a check and balance for your own liability and your own choices, then get the manufacturer's reps in your area and whatever and get them educated because, you know, they're going to come around and say you're right. You know, that person should have had a power wheelchair.
Real quick, I'm going to, in the interest of time, give you the number. It's 430. Great discussion. Please continue, but in case you have other...
Is he not the best volunteer the whole time?
Thank you.